Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. State lawmakers have wrapped up the regular session in the Connecticut General Assembly, and they passed a new two-year, $46 billion budget, but they're not quite done. A special session is scheduled this week to allow lawmakers a vote on whether to legalize cannabis for adults, and other items could pop up too. Today, Where We Live, we wrap up the session with Daniela Altomare, the Current's Capitol reporter, and we get analysis from columnist and former state lawmaker Kevin Rennie. What bills were you watching that did or didn't make it through? We'll take your questions too. 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR. Or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us on Zoom again, Daniela Altomare, who covers state government and politics at The Current. Daniela, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Kevin Rennie is here, as I mentioned, a columnist for The Current, and he used to be a state lawmaker. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning.
So we've had lots of conversations about how this session was very different from others because of the pandemic. And I'll start with you, Daniela. Remind us, as things started to loosen up around the state, what changed at the Capitol?
Well, I mean, it was a very weird session. Obviously, the building was closed to the public. Even now, as restrictions are lifted, there's no mask mandate at the Capitol. And yet, both the public and lobbyists are not permitted inside. So that obviously had a big impact on sort of the shape of the session and the way things went. And spoke with many, many people who said, from lobbyists who said they were having a very hard time reaching legislators. People weren't returning phone calls. It was very frustrating to members of the public who couldn't get access as well and also had that same difficulty. So that definitely, I think, shaped the outcome of a number of different bills.
Hey, Kevin, why is that problematic when we think about what happens in the final days of the legislative session to have those restrictions in place, that access still being limited?
Well, the biggest problem, I think, is that the legislators are denying themselves information that can be useful. In addition to that, we do have a constitutional right to petition our government. And part of that, certainly in Connecticut, the Constitution state has included access to the state capitol when the legislature is meeting. And it really can be very helpful. It's not just lobbyists who go there with interests in legislation. There can be people who have who've been following a bill or may have inspired a bill for a local legislator to propose, and not every group, by the way, has lobbyists. So it's important that they have access to the legislature in person, particularly in those frantic last few days. And it's also good for the legislators.
Kevin mentioned those frantic last few days, Daniela. So often you see big issues getting voted on in those last couple of days. So talk us through what happened in this session and how we ended up with a special session potentially starting tomorrow.
Yeah, I gather the Senate will be in on Tuesday and the House will be in on Wednesday. One of the biggest bills left undone was marijuana legalization, which did pass the Senate, but did not come up for a vote in the House. And, that was certainly a priority of many members of the General Assembly who wanted to get a vote on that. And it did not come up for a vote before time ran out at midnight on Wednesday. And the Democrats blamed the Republicans and said, or the opponents of the bill who said they would just talk it to death. Most of them are Republicans. They would just talk it to death and run out the calendar. But it does kind of raise the question, you know, if this was such a priority piece of legislation, why not get it done earlier? Why didn't they call the vote 2 weeks ago? Why didn't they negotiate this bill back in, you know, March and have it ready to go? So it does sort of raise some questions about the management of the legislative calendar. But that was certainly a big bill that was left undone. And that's part of the reason why they are coming back this week. There's also a budget related bill that they need to vote on. They did approve a state budget, but they did not approve the sort of bill that sets up the mechanics for approval of the state budget. So that, or implementation of the state budget rather. So that also was left undone. And, you know, there's always the chance that other issues could crop up. So we'll see what, you know, what ends up coming out this week.
Kevin, you wrote about the process related to that, again, recreational marijuana bill and this provision that was put in, then taken out. This we had Senator Winfield on the other day talking about it. And I'm wondering if you can talk about, again, this level of secrecy in the process and how that led to the failure of getting this done in the regular session.
Well, this is a major change. Whatever you think of the, wherever you may fall on the yes or no side of legalizing recreational use of marijuana, this is a major change in Connecticut policy. And to release a 300-page bill just the Sunday before the legislature was going to adjourn on Wednesday, that's a risk. No, that may be that the people supporting that bill and the Democratic leadership may have thought better this way than to give people too much time to examine it. But it's still a risk. And the House Republican leader, Vincent Candelora, found an unusual gift in there to someone that took them out of the lottery that we're going to see for licenses. And this is a very complicated process that we're about to embark on, that the Department of Consumer Protection will oversee. And for the public to have confidence in it, it needs to be transparent, and there need to be standards that are applied equally to everyone, because this can become a real bonanza of favors being done. And that appeared to be a favor for someone. It took them out of the competitive process, and it caused all sorts of other questions about what was in the bill. And if you're going to wait till the last minute, that's the risk you take in a 300-page bill.
Daniela, I'm wondering if you can talk through when this provision was put in the bill, how the governor's office got involved. Was it surprising to you that this was uncovered in the last few days of the session?
I didn't report too deeply on it. My colleague Chris Keating did, but I will say that no, it's absolutely not surprising, because that's what happens in those hectic final few hours. There's always all kinds of things in there that perhaps it done, you know, earlier and in the light of day and with people having time to really read and digest these documents would not get in there. But you know, that's the danger of this sort of frantic last minute lawmaking, where these massive bills are dropped on people at the last minute. Things are hidden in there. You know, they call them rats at the Capitol. And, you know, our colleague John Lender found something else in there, you know, raises for legislative employees. I mean, there's always things hidden in these bills that that the legislature hopes won't be discovered. That's just kind of the nature of lawmaking up there, and it's really not necessarily something that leads to good government and public scrutiny.
So set us up with how the special session will run, Daniela. Again, cannabis will be up for a vote, and I'm just wondering how you will see this process moving through in terms of the debate that they'll hear in the special session.
Yeah, I mean, we're all assuming cannabis will be up for a vote. But, you know, I've also had people say to me, there's a reason it didn't come up for a vote in the House. And there's a reason it barely passed the Senate. And maybe, you know, maybe the support isn't there. And maybe that's why it didn't come up. So who knows? There's some sort of technical issues that, you know, are important, I guess, you know, for process sake, whether the cannabis bill becomes part of this big budget implementation bill or whether it's run as a standalone bill. I don't know if members of the public are clearly, you know, all that interested or clued in on those level of mechanics, but it is important because this budget bill does need to be passed. So if they tie it to cannabis, it could be a way of trying to, you know, for the majority to try to kind of jam it in. On the other hand, it could also, you know, undermine this other important bill and leave them hanging. So, and again, you know, we don't really know once this Pandora's box is open, we don't know what other things could end up coming up. I know that there was a lot of unhappiness with the Democratic majorities in both chambers for not taking up this this climate bill, TCI, as it's known. And there's a lot of anger over that. And there's some discussion, maybe, you know, the governor's office indicated they'd be open to that. Maybe the legislature needs to look at that as well in special session, because that was not done. And you have to sort of ask yourself, why was that not done in a place where, you know, Democrats do hold strong majorities and they, you know, profess to believe that climate change is human caused and we need to do something about it. So why was that not done? So that's another thing. And there's probably a host of things that I don't know about that are also under discussion.
You're hearing Daniela Altamara here on Where We Live as we get a recap of the regular session, a special session before the Connecticut General Assembly starting up tomorrow in one of the chambers. Daniela covers state government politics for The Current. Kevin Rennie is also here, Hartford Current columnist and former state lawmaker. Before we take a call, and you can join us, 888-720-9677 or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Daniela said something that was, again, a point that we should spend some time on, the fact that we've got a Democratic governor, you've got a Democratic majority. So often it seems that state Republicans are kind of shut out of the process when it comes to some of these big bills, Kevin. But they were able to definitely voice up their opposition. And we saw, again, cannabis didn't get voted on the regular session. The opposition to TCI also, you know, the way that this was crafted in the final days. I'm wondering if you can talk about the Republicans' strategy here.
The Republicans become powerful in the last week of the legislature, particularly the last 3 days of the legislative session, because the clock becomes so critical. And with their members, they're in the habit of being able to talk a long time, and so they are able to use that advantage in those critical last 3 days. And so if the Democratic leaders don't get what they really want passed before the final part of the session, they've made themselves vulnerable. You know, it wouldn't matter how long the Republicans would have talked on a marijuana bill that was brought up in April. But that's the price that the Democrats, I guess, were willing to pay. And I guess some unpleasantness ensued, and they sort of tested one another. And the leadership decided not to bring up the marijuana bill. Now, at that point, Daniela raised an interesting point, which is the vote in the Senate was very close at 1917, with six Democrats voting against it. You know, maybe the vote in the House was going to be close, and they weren't sure of the of the number of yes votes they had, and the Republicans would have been aware of that and taken advantage of that as well. And some of the unease as to what's really in this 300-page bill might have spread among wavering Democrats.
You can join us if you have a question about this regular session, 888-720-9677. Alex is calling in from West Hartford. Alex, I know you were curious about TCI being covered in the special session. I'm wondering if we can ask you how you feel about the way lawmakers navigated this issue.
I feel that it was very, very short-sighted of the leadership to not bring TCI nor the medium and heavy duty vehicles standards bill for a vote nor the electric vehicle, the direct sale of electric vehicles bill. Connecticut has a huge opportunity to pioneer green technologies, but we need to put the polluters' money to bear that cost. We need to cap pollution on the biggest polluters and require that they pay for our special transportation projects, such as electric buses, better walkable streets, bikeable streets, EV charging stations. This is a huge missed opportunity for our state and a huge missed opportunity to fight climate change.
Well, Alex, thank you for your call. We're going to be talking more about the Transportation and Climate Initiative program later this week on Where We Live. But Daniela, I wanted to go back to you when we talk about TCI. This was to cap and reduce greenhouse gases from the transportation sector and then invest in a cleaner transportation system for Connecticut and the region. What does it mean for Connecticut if they're not part of this regional project?
I mean, it's unclear at this point, but certainly some of the other states in this compact have already said, like Massachusetts, that this was meant to be a regional approach. And if other states, such as Connecticut, don't get on board, it could undermine, you know, the whole thing for other states beyond our borders. I mean, I spoke to a young climate activist with the Sunrise Movement who just really doesn't understand why, you know, when you hear these lawmakers who talk so much about how they believe in science and how they're going to be guided by science, and they believe that climate change is real and caused by humans, they can't get this fairly, you know, simple piece of legislation done. And by simple, I mean, it's obviously very complex, dealing with carbon credits and things like that. But, you know, they're looking ahead to, you know, 40 years when we're going to be in a much more dire situation and we're going to need much more extreme measures to deal with, you know, climate related issues. So in their minds, you know, it's quite discouraging that this generation of lawmakers who are up there at the Capitol, Democrats, Democratic majorities among them, cannot get this done. And they're angry and they're upset. It's really been interesting to hear their perspectives.
Kevin, again, we've heard from Senator Kelly and others calling this a gas tax. Daniela mentioned this program is complicated. Is that part of the issue, that the way that the supporters talked about this? When people hear gas tax, whether or not that is true, that's what the public hears, and that led to there being some questions about whether this could pass this session.
Oh, I do think that's true. It did have elements of the gas tax controversies that have been almost a permanent part of Connecticut politics, and it also gave the Republicans something to latch onto, because as the state's fiscal outlook improved, it was getting harder and harder for the Republicans to oppose. It's hard for them to oppose a no tax increase budget, and many of them did not. Many of them voted for it. If we could just for a moment, the issue of the direct sale of electric vehicles is in Connecticut is really a case study in how the system works. Sometimes we don't allow the direct manufacturers to sell vehicles directly to consumers in Connecticut. We haven't for, well, maybe 100 years, but close to it. And Tesla wants an exemption from that law. And this has been going on for years. And it shows the power of the automobile dealers, who are, I mean, ask any legislator or even local official. Automobile dealers are very active in their communities, and they participate in a lot of events and with a lot of groups, and they're generous donors. And I think that this legislation may be one of the few that they ever asked for anything from a local legislator. And that I think that the proponents of exempting Tesla from our automobile franchise law discovered that again this year. They've seen it before. They thought they were really close this year, but they just didn't have the votes.
One last word, going back to the TCI bill, Anthony tweeting us, the TCI bill has been drafted since early in the session, but Senator Looney has been blocking debate and a vote. He goes on, this isn't a new proposal. The Transportation and Climate Initiative multi-state process started way back in 2010. So we'll see if it pops up this special session starting in another day or two. My guest, Kevin Rennie, Hartford Current columnist and former state lawmaker, also with us, Daniela Altomare, who covers state government and politics at the Hartford Current. We'll be back after a short break. You can join us too, 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR. Or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. Hartford Healthcare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers, so we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford Healthcare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In Community Speaker Series May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speaker-series. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We wanted to spend some time recapping the legislative session that just wrapped up last week, but they'll be back starting tomorrow for a special session. On Zoom with us, Daniela Altomare, who covers state government and politics at the Hartford Current, and Kevin Rennie, a former state lawmaker and now Hartford Current columnist. We were talking about what didn't pass this legislative session, but I wanted both of you to talk a little bit about some of the bills that made it through that you thought were really impactful. Daniela, I'll start with you.
Well, there was a there were a lot of bills that had been kicking around in years past, like this proposal to end the religious exemption for childhood vaccinations, not COVID, but other childhood vaccinations such as mumps and measles and things like that. That passed this year, and actually that passed fairly early in the legislative session. So I think that was a big win for people who wanted to see that. That's one that had been kicking around for a while. They also passed this deceptive advertising for pregnancy centers, which was another issue that had support in the Capitol in years past. They passed a bill, I think this was really interesting, to address the rising number of pedestrian and bike fatalities. And that's something that I think, at least for the past couple of years, had been put forth and finally, you know, got over the finish line. So those are three things that you know, certainly had a lot of advocates. Of course, the vaccine bill also has a lot of critics, and they were very vocal and spent many hours at the Capitol rallying and protesting, including on the final day. So it'll be interesting to see where that one winds up, probably in the courts at some point, but, or it already is in the courts, actually. So those are things that, you know, had been sort of mulled for a while and finally got through. There was a zoning bill that was you know, to address racial isolation through zoning. That was, you know, greatly sort of reduced, but that did pass, but it wasn't what the proponents had had sought. So those were a few of the ones I'm thinking of right off the top of my head.
You mentioned the zoning, it was significantly watered down. So what will it do, Daniela?
Well, I mean, as I remember it, a lot of what it will do is, you know, direct people to study the issue. It did put some measures in place to allow, you know, people to have so-called, you know, in-law apartments in some cases. But the real sort of strong elements of it, like, allowing multifamily zoning in transit-oriented areas, you know, downtowns and things like that, that is, a lot of that was taken out of the bill.
And Kevin, how about you? What were some of the bills that stuck out to you that actually are making it to the governor's desk?
Well, I think that the remnants of the original zoning proposal, it was taken out, much more interesting, or I guess, than what was kept in. But it was a reminder that local zoning in Connecticut is an area that legislators of both parties are very reluctant to trespass on. They're really in touch with the people in their communities, and I think that Democrats and Republicans are leery of making big changes in what local zoning authorities can do, and this is an overwhelmingly Democratic controlled legislature. And the governor is a Democrat, and you think if there was going to be a time to make these changes, that this would be it, and they just fell far short of that. In 169 towns in Connecticut, still, no matter what are the other changes there may be, and there are some immutables in that.
Do you anticipate this issue will come back the next session, Kevin?
Yes. Yeah, I do. I mean, it may come back from the advocates, but I think that legislators would be even less likely to address it in an election year. I mean, this session is as far as they get from the next election, and they didn't want to do it. They didn't want to do it this year, so they're unlikely to want to do it next year, 6 months or so before they face the voters.
There were a lot of criminal justice bills before the legislature, also looking at, you know, how incarcerated people are treated within our prison system. We look at limiting solitary confinement. But there was also a bill, I think, that made it through, Kevin, that you think needs to be highlighted. Yeah. And that's, you know, the free phone calls for people that are incarcerated.
I do. We should have done this a long time ago, because it is a penalty to charge the incarcerated and their families, essentially, a lot of money for phone calls. And really, part of helping people re-enter society after they serve their term is a connection with their family. That's one of the most important factors in successfully leaving a prison and not returning to it. And that phone call is a lifeline. It really is an important aspect of families staying in touch, and that they've been denied that access for too long. And Gary Winfield deserves a lot of credit for getting that passed. It's also a big business, so he went up against some other interests, and he prevailed, and good for him.
Chris is calling in from Weathersfield. Chris, go ahead with your question.
Yes, I keep hearing a lot of explanations of our state's problems that have to deal with process. And in business that changes so much, there's a usually a group that does, you know, process engineering, re-engineering. You know, systems do have to change with the times. Processes have to change. I'd like to know who or where in the state is in charge of doing that so that we don't keep hearing the same problems year after year after year, governor after governor.
Good question, Chris. I'll start with you, Danielle. I know some people have talked about the importance of a full-time legislature.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is just the nature of government. Government moves slowly and cumbersomely in a lot of ways. But yeah, having a full-time legislature maybe would address some issues, but it might also raise other issues. So I'm not sure. I mean, you can say, well, we have a full-time Congress, and allegedly full-time Congress, what do they do? So maybe that's not the answer, but maybe it is. I don't know. Maybe it's time to try it.
We've been spending a lot of time talking about the legislature, but I didn't want to have this segment end without talking about the governor's role in all of this, including transparency, which is a big issue, especially when the press tries to cover this administration. Kevin, you've been dealing with the transparency question with the Lamont administration. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's hard to believe that Governor Lamont in his youth was a newspaper editor, because his office is, and I think it reflects him, his attitude as governor. They are just very resistant to transparency and to releasing documents under their Freedom of Information Act and dragging their feet. The Current has had a request pending documents relating to the reopening commission from last spring. It's been pending for a year, and still they've received not a single document from the governor's office, which on that issue in particular specifically pledged transparency, because the governor had handed over the job of advising him to an entity that was not subject to the Freedom of Information Act or to the protections of our state ethics code. And yet they failed, and there's just a general resistance in his administration, particularly in his office, to the Freedom of Information Act, which is one of Connecticut's glories.
So you were talking about that issue with the Current. I know the Day has been upset with the governor for passing along the Freedom of Information related to the state peer. Danielle, I wanted to get your take on what you're noticing. I mean, obviously the governor and his team had often daily briefings, at least to the start in the middle of the pandemic, frequent briefings with the press and others. But if you're not, handing over documents that also put the light on the process, that can be problematic.
Sure. And I think Kevin raises a good point about sort of the way that this has been managed and who's doing, you know, who is actually doing the work, and whether it is entities that are subject to Freedom of Information. You know, on the other hand, you can look at from the governor's point of view, you know, do people really care? Obviously, we in the news business feel they should care. This is a democracy. But the governor's ratings have never been higher. He's very popular. People think he did a good job running, you know, handling the pandemic. Even some Republicans think he did a good job handling the pandemic. So perhaps, you know, his perspective is really, you know, the press can be mad, and we don't need to be as open as we should be, as we're required to be under the law, because the public really doesn't care. They're giving me good grades for the way I'm running the state.
That's an interesting point, but we know the pandemic, the new normal, as we're all calling it, things are starting to get back to normal. And we remember what the administration was like, Kevin, before the pandemic, and how they handled issues like tolls. And, you know, we know this pandemic, yes, Luckily will be ending soon. But the question of how this administration continues to run state government beyond a public health crisis.
Oh, yeah. I think that's true. I think I would add to what Daniela said, that I think a lot of Republicans appreciated the governor's steady hand, but that's not necessarily a license that's going to be valid for the rest of his term. And what I think that elected officials sometimes forget in the moment is that the Freedom of Information Act is for their benefit too. It is a reminder, an important reminder, that someone's going to see what you did. And so you want to think about that before you exercise your authority in the people's business. And it really can be an important part of a governing philosophy if you don't decide that you're going to ignore it for as long as you possibly can.
And lastly, you've been dealing with a protracted fight with the administration over your FOIA requests related to the governor's wife, Annie Lamott, and her role in the administration. Can you briefly tell us where this stands?
Well, it's that my request was for emails and text messages between the two of the governor's top aides and Mrs. Lamott. That was in August of 2019. Documents were withheld and others were redacted. We had hearings with it for a hearing officer in December and February of this year. And then we had there was a Freedom of Information Commission meeting last week to consider adopting the hearing officer's recommendation, which I had hoped they would, and there seemed to be some objection to that at the last minute, and so it was posted. A final decision was postponed for 2 weeks in order to give members of the commission who would like to a chance to look at those documents. And of course, the odd thing about all this is that I make the case, but I'm the only one who hasn't seen what's behind the redactions and what documents have been withheld. So the hearing officer sees that, and really you have to rely on the hearing officer's judgment when you can't see the documents.
Well, we can't wait to hear how this ends up for you, Kevin Rennie. We appreciate your time here on Where We Live, talking about this very important issue, as well as recapping the legislative session. Thanks for your time today. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And Daniela Altamare was here, who covers state government and politics of the Hartford Current. You'll be back at it tomorrow, Daniela, with the start of the special session. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. And our listeners know the governor's office. We've had the governor on pretty regularly throughout the pandemic. His last time on our show was March 24th. We've been trying to get him back on to answer your questions. We know you have a lot of them, and we're still waiting to hear back. After the break, we'll talk about another bill that made it through the end of this session. This will expand Husky healthcare coverage for some children. We'll find out more. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Now, one of the bills that made it through near the end of the session expands the state's Medicaid program, or Husky, and helps the undocumented population in our state. Joining us now to talk about this legislation on Zoom, Francis Padilla, president of the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut. Francis, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Lucy. Thanks for inviting me.
So briefly, remind us about the Husky program currently and how this will be expanded to help some in the undocumented population.
Yes, sure. The Husky program in Connecticut is our Medicaid program, and it is actually made up of four different programs that cover children, that cover single adults, that cover families as well. And it has not done ever is actually included coverage for people who are not legally present in Connecticut. So people who are immigrants without documentation have not been able to qualify even on the basis of income for Husky coverage in Connecticut up until now.
So when we talk about this bill that made it through, I know it's limited, I believe, to pregnant mothers and then children up to the age of 8. Why did it become so limited? I know this isn't what the advocates originally asked for.
Yes. Well, the original bill really was looking for all undocumented immigrants to be eligible for HUSCI, and that would include all children up to the age of 18 and all adults, again, people who are income eligible. This effort was really part of a broader set of healthcare coverage initiatives designed to close coverage gaps and affordability gaps in Connecticut that have been longstanding because they have existed even before the COVID pandemic, but the pandemic actually accentuated the need for this kind of coverage. And so when in the negotiations, essentially, there just wasn't sufficient political will to cover everyone in the undocumented community under the HUSCI program. And there was then a decision. So there was a bill that was originally Senate Bill 956, which would have covered everybody. And after much back and forth, it became clear that that would not happen. And the legislative leadership then introduced House Bill 6687, which was considerably more limited to children under the age of 9 and to pregnant women for prenatal care, and then for a year, up to a year of post-birth care. This is really the beginning. Several states, a half dozen other states, have expanded their Medicaid coverage to the undocumented. Some have started with children up to age 18. And so this is only the beginning, and it's a good outcome in the sense of it's better than nothing, but it really is only the beginning, and there needs to be much more work done.
I wanted to get some personal perspective on this issue. Joining us now on the phone is Katia Daly, who's a campaign organizer, healthcare campaign organizer with CT Students for a Dream. Katia, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
I understand you provided testimony to the General Assembly about why this expansion of HUSCI for those who are undocumented is needed. Can you tell us a little bit about your personal story?
Yeah. So I am formerly undocumented, and this bill is very important to me. When I was still undocumented while I was still in high school, I played different sports, one of them which was volleyball, and there was an accident actually in the court where I had sprained my ankle, and I hid this from my coach, my peers, because of the reason that my parents couldn't afford the healthcare that I might need and the support that I might need for a sprained ankle. So I kind of deal with the pain until I started limping. So when that happened, my coach kind of took me out, and I started like crying and having a very anxiety attack, basically. And a lot of my peers were saying, like, it's okay, the pain will go away. But one of the reasons why I was crying wasn't because of so much of the pain. It was more about how was I going to let my parents know that I will become a financial burden to them through this process. We weren't be able to go. I didn't want to go to the emergency room. They wanted to take me there. I was like, there's no way that I'm going to be able to do that. We can't afford that. And there, a lot of the things that came to my mind was that I needed to make sure that I was able to heal at home. And for this, it might have been a bit of a situation where I couldn't have been able to play volleyball again because of how my ankle would have healed. Thankfully, my school was able to provide me with some financial aid for the therapy, the physical therapy, and some other care that has helped me to deal with that. But you know, that was a very traumatic experience for me as I was like 15 years old trying to figure out how my parents could afford this.
Yeah, we know how healthcare costs can really spiral out of control, especially when you don't have insurance. So, Katia, I'm glad that you're able to get help with your injury. But Katia's story, Francis, you know, speaks to this bigger issue in the sense that, you know, people that are uninsured, the choices they have to make, whether they go and get care and how they're going to pay for it. You said that there wasn't political will to help this expansion to cover more than just children up to age 8 and pregnant mothers, you know, regardless of their immigration status. I'm wondering if you can talk about, you know, why that is. Is it because of the misconceptions that people who are undocumented are taking advantage of the system?
Yes, there's a lot of misconceptions and a lot of fear that that having access to these kinds of resources will inundate the system and that we can't possibly afford it. And the reality is that as with people who are citizens or otherwise legally present in Connecticut and in the United States, care foregone is care that ends up being more expensive. And we've said this at Universal Healthcare Foundation our entire existence, that it really is makes no sense to not have everyone covered so that you can get the preventive care, which is much less expensive than more specialized and acute care needed later when people, you know, don't go for their physicals or don't take care of situations like Katia's accident. At the public hearing in March for this bill, there were over 250 people who submitted testimony, including, you know, healthcare providers, some a doctor's organization called Doctors for America, which we have a Connecticut chapter of, submitted testimony from some 300 physicians. And of course, there were also some immigrants who themselves told their stories. A woman who went into the emergency room, pregnant 24 weeks, was not feeling well, was really badly treated and was turned away, was sent home. And when she returned because she didn't feel well, she then had a stillbirth. And these are you know, traumatic experiences that none of us who have insurance, who take it for granted, would accept under any circumstances. And so the need for having everyone covered is really a public health measure. It really is important for all of us to be able to be covered through whatever means make the most sense, right? And to be able to get the care that is needed. It makes human sense, right? Health sense, and it makes financial sense as well. Mm-hmm.
We just have a couple of minutes left, Francis. Again, this is just the first step. Do you anticipate that this could be brought up again and you could see a Husky expansion that would cover more people?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The governor has to sign this bill, and so the advocacy for his signature continues as I speak. And then the intention is to return and to continue to pursue coverage of all undocumented immigrants, providing access to some, you know, it's between 65 and 70,000 people. It's not even that many individuals. It's about half the people who are in our state who are known to be undocumented who need coverage. And so making affordable access to quality care available to them is something that the coalition of organizations of which we at Universal are part will definitely return and keep fighting for.
Mm. Katia, we heard from you earlier. I'm wondering if you could just tell us, you know, how you feel about this particular bill getting passed and the work that still needs to be done.
Yeah, so I'm very happy that this bill was able to pass, although it has a lot of shortcomings. We have talked about what will be the expansion for immigrant children and pregnant women. We understand that there has been a lot of a lot of advocacy that our community has done and will continue to do. It is very important that we continue to advocate for our lives. This is the life or death situation for some of us. And it's important to understand that our lives are dependent on this bill. So we will continue to fight our coalition of community members, organizations, and healthcare advocates will continue to fight for the healthcare expansion of all our community members.
Well, thank you, Katia Daly, for coming on the show, a healthcare campaign organizer with Connecticut Students for a Dream. We appreciate your time. And Francis Padilla, president of the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut, we'd love to have you back. There's a lot of issues to talk about related to healthcare. Thank you, Francis.
Thank you for inviting me. We'd love to come back.
I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. Kat Pastor is our technical producer. You can listen to Where We Live anytime on your favorite podcast app. Back tomorrow.